Well, good morning. I thought I'd start off this talk with the title that I know I spoke at this conference in 2010, the same meeting. And I asked this question, does winter canola fit in Montana? And my answer at that time was yes, with some qualifications. I thought I needed some fall irrigation to get it going, but pretty confident that we could get it to go. And then I posed five follow-up questions at that time. I was really curious about the rainfall pattern that would make fall establishment feasible without irrigation. Based on talking to a lot of people at this conference, I went away with ideas about what alternative stubbles we should be looking at. We'd only been working in wheat stubble up to that point, and wheat stubble wasn't working for us, too cool a microclimate. And then there were some other questions. I thought maybe we'd seen some better survival in deep placement. You'll see based on what I'm going to show you today, that probably would take us in the wrong direction. At that time, we couldn't even find winter canola for farmers to plant. That actually got solved at this meeting. Before I left the room, somebody made a contact that would prove very helpful. And then, we're still always looking for more winter hardy types that hug that soil a little tighter. And then one other piece to the puzzle, in 2011 we had a study in Bozeman where we had fair to good survival in all our plots that were oriented in an east-west direction and complete mortality in a north-south direction. And it was the same variety, the same planting day, same fertilizer, same everything, same stubble, but they're both in wheat stubble. It was just really puzzling how that one difference could give us an acceptable result to complete death. And it happened in both winter pea and winter canola, and so that certainly caused some head scratching, and it was obviously related to wet conditions in the spring. It was not related, the canola looked good coming out from under the snow. So that caused us to come up with this project. And that, hence the title, was Solving Spring Canola for Winter Canola in Montana, and that was a really presumptuous title, so that's why I've got a question mark behind it now. I should have had that there sooner. I want to acknowledge co-author. I was really convinced that there was a plant pathology angle here that we needed to work on, so Mary Burrows is a really capable plant pathologist at MSU, and Jeff Holmes, you'll see, he does the field work on this stuff, and it was, we needed a pretty talented guy to pull off this experiment. But just back up a second. Where, I don't know if the mouse works here or not. When I was here in 2010, this yellow piece is the canola acres. So we were thinking canola was about to go extinct in Montana because it'd really come down to some trivial amounts. It has taken off again. I just got these numbers for 2014 last week. I expected to see them higher, but at least it's back to being a marginally significant crop for us. And why winter canola? Just a reminder, this is a study. I've got bushels per acre at a 10% moisture on the left. A couple of different years, 2007, 2009, these are other winter canola studies where we had both spring canola and winter canola in the same experiment. The dark shaded bars are where we had all the management practices line up, so I would consider this the best management practice. The light color, the light shading is kind of the average result for the trial. So you can see 2007, our best management, we didn't quite hit 30 bushels. Our best management, when we lined everything up with winter canola, the right seeding date, right variety, right plant density, all that sort of thing, we got almost to 90 bushels. So 3x yield, that gets your attention. 2009, this was 2007, you remember, was a really hot, dry year. We set some record heat numbers in July. 2009, it wasn't as big a difference, but still, whether you compared the best management or the average management, still a significant advantage to winter canola. So if we were going to get winter canola, getting canola acres up in Montana, I thought winter canola was pretty critical. And so I'll tell you about this plot experiment. The main plot is the row direction. So we did east-west. Coincidentally, it's downslope. It's not a steep slope at all, but it is downslope. North-south is across the slope. And it's a lot harder to do than you might think. And I'll show you the pictures here in a minute. Subplot is the crop stubble. So within each of these orientations, I had pea stubble, something that was a nice, warm, dark soil surface so I could get good fall emergence, good spring growth, a short wheat stubble, 4-inch, a tall wheat stubble. And those had some effects, you'll see. Two varieties, the subplots were factorial, two varieties and two nitrogen strategies. here's the varieties, and then the nitrogen differences were just basically a full feed banded at seeding versus a starter and then broadcast in the spring with the remainder, which was the bulk of it. Just the soil climate context, a very deep soil. This is wind-derived soil. Kind of like the P&W in that regard. I have fine sandy loam. It's a really productive soil. We have wet winters, lots of snow, dry summers, that sort of thing. We did have some bad luck. 2012 was the driest crop year we ever recorded at this research site. So we didn't have the greatest crop stubbles, especially on the wheat side. I would have liked to have had denser stubbles for the wheat stubble. 2013, look at the second driest. So back-to-back, we set two records. And that wasn't conducive to disease, so it made Mary Burrow's efforts a little more difficult to do. Here's what the plots look like on October 9th. So we've got nice emergence. That's the pea stubble in the foreground, the tall wheat stubble behind it. By the end of November, we're going into winter. You can see there is, there's some this dark material between the snow. That's the canola cabbage or biomass. So we had some really nice establishment. You see the tall wheat stubble behind it. Now we're coming out of winter. This is March 10th. I want you to notice that the tall wheat stubble actually hung on to snow, a day or three longer than anything else in there. And that'll come back later in the study. Here's that's pea stubble on the far right, next to tall wheat stubble. One thing we noticed, Mary observed this, is every one of our canola plants had a split subcrown area. So obviously some ice formation and bursting that crown. And so you could imagine that might be a good venue for disease to enter the system. That was a particularly bad one. But in this year, with a nice dry spring, it didn't manifest into any particular disease. But we do see that very routinely. By May, third week of May, we've got nice flowering going on. Here's an overview shot of the site. And then, where I've got P is pea stubble, TW is tall wheat, short wheat. And you can see the tall wheat looks a little more ragged in each of these reps. And I think that had to do with, I'll show you, it's not necessarily stand, but it just was a little bit later in coming. So those stands looked a little more ragged. In terms of results, it's really quite a simple story here. There were no treatment effects on fall stand density, so it didn't matter which way we seeded them. We were aiming for 200 plants per meter squared. We got to 198, so I'm going to give my technician full marks on that one. We did measure fall biomass just prior to freeze-up, and we had that full nitrogen versus the starter N treatment, and we did have a one-third greater biomass where we had the full feed of N, so I thought, bigger, stronger plants going into the winter, that might manifest into something. We, despite having no treatment effects here, and no treatment effects in stand density in the spring, we did lose almost half our stand over the winter. Which is something we've often seen. I try to seed my winter canola at 2x because I know I'm going to come out of it with a normal stand then. We did see some interesting directional effects. We actually had 22%. I measured biomass again in the spring just prior to bolting, and we had 22% higher biomass, and this is statistically significant in the east-west direction, which was the same way that we'd had beneficial growth in 2011 versus the north-south, but you'll see it didn't really turn into anything. And there was a little interaction. This is that pre-bolt biomass again, kilograms per hectare dry matter here on the left. This is roughly the same as pounds per acre. We had one of the varieties, the high class 154, in the tall wheat stubble. I think it had a little longer internode, and it didn't get going as well in the spring as in that particular combination. So it was significantly less than the other five combinations there. In terms of seed yield, though, so here's the punchline. For 2013, our second driest year ever recorded, I'm very pleased overall, I have to say, with these kind of seed yields. It really turned out well that way. And I maybe didn't emphasize this enough at the start of the presentation. I've been playing with this for probably 15 years at this location. If we get a dry spring, it seems to work pretty well. If we get a wet spring, it doesn't work well at all. This was a dry spring, and that seems to be the critical aspect for us to at least get those plants up and growing in the spring. Not major differences in yield. Surprisingly to me, the short wheat stubble actually yielded less than the pea stubble. This tall wheat was later and more ragged, so I expected that number to come to be lower, but I'm really still a little puzzled as to how it yielded that well. It took longer maturity in that tall wheat stubble, about 2.5 days longer. And again, I think that's just it was under snow longer. It took a little longer to get going in the spring. We had a big difference in maturity between the varieties. This 4615 was 5 days earlier than high class overall. So, and as a result, in this very dry year, it yielded substantially greater. 400 pounds per acre. Fertilizer nitrogen regime had no effect on any yield parameter. Oil yield was low overall, probably consistent with a pretty low or pretty dry production condition. Mary Burrow spent a lot of time digging around these plots, and we could not find one diseased plant in here. So that was a disappointment. I better hurry up here. We tagged on to a local farm field after that, thinking, well, we didn't find disease here. We had one farmer that was doing pretty well with this. This is his stand October 10th. By mid-January, he had still had nice biomass there, but it had a lot of black spores on some of the dead leaf material. We got a diagnosis of avirulent blackleg on that. By March, it's still, you could see, it's purpled off, but it's coming out of winter. I thought we were still going to have a really good field. In fact, that's what I told this grower, but by mid-April, that's what it looks like. And I even went out a week later to see if it did the Lazarus thing and came back to life, and no, it was still dead. But if you can see on this knoll here, there's some green there, and any flat area in the field was completely dead. So the little bit of anything that was a little bit convex, we had some, that would have probably made a decent crop, but any flat area and certainly any depressional areas were completely dead. So where does this lead? I'm giving up with winter canola. I've been playing with this for 15 years, and I'm out of ideas. Almost, but I'm trying it one more time. We're losing it in the spring due to wet soil conditions. I've visited with Malcolm about that. I know they've had some similar experiences like that in eastern Canada. There does not seem to be any pathology involved, at least nothing directly related. I'm out of ideas.
Got time for some questions?
Do you have any ideas? Yeah, no, I think the potential is actually pretty small unless we make a major breakthrough of some sort. So I was focusing on the Rocky Mountain front area where we get really consistent winter wheat survival. We do have some regions, and that actually would be a pretty substantial acreage. The key for me there was, can I get it going in time in the fall? This picture, we had the most rain I've ever had in late August. I mean, it varied anywhere from 2.5 to 8 inches in one event, depending where you were in Montana. It was great for starting winter canola. So that's a dryland trial that I've got going on Bozeman, but how often that's going to happen, I don't know. So I think, we need to get it working a little bit before we can even figure out what the potential acreage is. But
how about spring canola?
Well, spring canola, it's big, but it burns up. It always looks beautiful in June. And, come the 1st of July, when it's just about the time of starting to fill pods, it just doesn't finish. The harvest index are really low. We've had better luck the last few years because we've actually had rain in July. That's been a new thing, and that's cool. I'd like to see more of that, actually. So, yeah.
Did you ever frost seed spring canola?
Yeah, I've done the dormant seeding, frost seeding thing, and that was a real hit and miss thing also. I mean, you could hit a home run with it one year, and the next year it would be a zero. Yeah.
Got time for one more.
Have you investigated seeding rates?
We have had quite a look at seeding rates, and so that best management that we got to 89 bushels, that was actually, I think, one of the components there. It wasn't the major player, but it was like a 400 seeds per meter squared seeding rate that helped us get that better plant stand. So it's not, I mean, when you lose it all, Mike, it's, I don't think it's really going to matter. Unless you've got an idea there that I haven't thought of, or an angle.
Thank you.
Thank you.